I'm very happy now to welcome Carolyn Eisenstein. She is a National Science Foundation officer.
Yes.
Who was at the South Pole. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So how did you find yourself a science person at the South Pole of all places?
Well, I worked for the National Science Foundation as a program officer, not in polar research, but each year they send one person to the pole to cover the pole throughout the austral summer, which is actually only 3 months, November, December, and January. And that person's job as science representative is to report back to the NSF, the National Science Foundation, about the progress and activity in each of the science projects being funded that summer and going on at that very time. I was there in December of 2000. So I surveyed all the projects going on and sent a report each week to the Science Foundation about the progress and issues, should there be some. Also, my job was to run interference between the visitors, the distinguished visitors to the South Pole, and the scientists. So, we had delegations from Congress, delegations from NSF and other agencies, delegations from the military, and so forth. And so that scientists could concentrate on their work in this very compressed 3-month period, I did most of the orientation for the visitors, which means that my earlier work on summarizing the work going on was very handy.
It's interesting. I mean, I would think for scientists, distinguished visitors would just be kind of in the way.
Yes, they could be, and that's why I was there to help orient them, show them around, take them here and there, and watch whether they had altitude sickness or were getting dehydrated or whatever. Take them to the souvenir shop so they could buy the obligatory Antarctic t-shirt.
There's a souvenir shop on the South Pole?
Yes, we have souvenirs flown in so that people can buy souvenirs. I have several t-shirts and fleeces and things that say South Pole Station.
Yeah, I would think the fleeces would be more practical.
The fleeces are very popular. But the third thing was to organize talks available to all the staff on the science that was being done and on other activities, because at the time I was at the pole, there were 50 scientists, there were about 170 support staff of various kinds and construction workers and so forth, working their heart out. But it's important for them to know and feel excited about the science that's going on because they are supporting that science. So one of my jobs was to arrange things, informational and fun discussions for the whole community there.
I think it's important to make a distinction between the South Pole and the whole of Antarctica. Antarctica is a very big place. And the science that's being done and the stations that exist at the South Pole are not the same that are happening at the ice shelves that are falling off and all of that.
That's right. And in the talk I will give to the students for the Science Cafe, I will focus on the South Pole. I won't talk about putting monitors on seals or studying penguin colonies or the ice shelves falling off, because those things are basically going forward at what's called the Antarctic Peninsula. It's that part of Antarctica that projects up towards South America. The main American station in Antarctica is called McMurdo Station, and it is in that part of the continent that projects up toward Australia and New Zealand. And I flew to New Zealand, and then from New Zealand to McMurdo Station on a C-130 Hercules cargo plane, landed on the ice and spent a couple of days there, and then flew to the South Pole another 800 miles inland. And so I will talk with the students about the work that's going on at the South Pole, simply because it's impossible in the time I have with them to talk about research in the whole of Antarctica.
So what kind of research is happening at the South Pole?
We'll focus on basically two areas, telescopes that are used to study the structure and origin of the universe, and instruments that are used to study Earth's atmosphere and cryosphere, cryo meaning the frozen part. And this all could seem a little esoteric, but for the students At the cafe, I'll put it in context by starting with the early explorers, the first two guys, teams actually, that went to the pole in 1911 and 1912. Roald Amundsen, the Norwegian explorer, reached the pole in December of 1911 with his dog sleds. Robert Scott reached the pole in January of 1912, only to find the Norwegian flag posted there.
to his great annoyance.
Yes, and he had tried to come pulling his sleds with Mongolian ponies who died en route. So he was actually man-hauling, pulling his sleds, and he died on the way back, whereas Amundsen got back fine. But one of the people who had been with Scott, not on his expedition to the South Pole, but at his base, which is where McMurdo is today, was named Apsley Cherry Gerard, and he wrote a wonderful book called The Worst Journey in the World. And I love a quote from his book, which says, "There are many reasons which send men to the poles, but the desire for knowledge for its own sake is the one which really counts. If you have the desire for knowledge and the power to give it physical expression, go out and explore." That's a century ago, and that was their motivation, and that's the same motivation today. We go out to explore, but it's scientific exploration, not just geological or geographical exploration.
Why put telescopes in Antarctica when you have a whole world of accessible Earth masses on which you can also put telescopes?
Not all telescopes do well. The telescopes that are at the South Pole are doing observation in the microwave frequency, that's millimeter frequency, and they're studying things like the cosmic microwave background. Now, water vapor absorbs microwaves. That's why you can heat water in your microwave oven. And so if you want to study microwaves, you've got to get to the driest place you can find. And on Earth, that is the South Pole. You can go into space, obviously, also, which is more costly, believe it or not, because it does seem like going to the South Pole is an enormous endeavor. Everything you need there has to be flown in, transported, first shipped to just New Zealand, then to the continent, and then to the South Pole. So it's an enormous undertaking. But the goal is to do radio and microwave astronomy, and to try to understand the early universe. Now, there also is an experiment there that it was just starting when I was there in 2000 and is now progressing very nicely. That is to use the fact that at the South Pole, you have a 2-mile-deep chunk of ice that's pretty pristine, almost totally pristine, and we're using it as a detector for our high-energy neutrinos from the original sort of Big Bang era. So,
hang on, you have a layer of ice on the South Pole that's 2 miles thick?
That's right, and the actual...
So to get to land, you have to go through 2 miles of ice.
Correct, and even probably down further because they think that the bedrock is depressed from the weight of the ice. But it is nevertheless a continent. It is not like the North Pole, which is ice sheets floating on water. This is truly a continent. And yes, it's 2 miles. And so when you're there, the altitude at the South Pole is 9,300 feet. But what's called the physiological altitude is anywhere between 10,000 and 13,000 feet. And that's because you're at the spin axis of the Earth. The Earth is rotating. The air at the South Pole is thinner than the air at the equator at a comparable altitude. You know, so we're spinning. So when the air...
You're spinning the air away, so to speak?
Away, so to speak. And when the air's thinner, the barometric pressure's less oxygen, your body says higher altitude.
So aside from all the science, which I want to get back to in a moment, just acclimating to the South Pole is a multidimensional task. You're coming from probably a different time zone, a different climate, a different amount of air, a different altitude, and it's really cold.
It's very cold. Yes, and the program, the U.S. Antarctic program, takes that into account as they help people adapt. I mean, I did Thanksgiving in Chicago with my family, flew to L.A., flew to Auckland, New Zealand, which took 14 hours over nothing but Pacific Ocean the whole time. then flew from Auckland, which is the northern island of New Zealand, down to the southern island, to Christchurch. Then spent a couple of days, then flew to McMurdo, which is 8 hours, 2,400 miles, with no alternative landing site. So the pilots on the, our Hercules cargo plane are monitoring the weather conditions in McMurdo. Can we land? Can we see the ice and differentiate it from the atmosphere, from the air? So it, about 4 hours into the flight, halfway, they have to make a decision. Do we continue on or do we go back, which is called boomerang? I was very fortunate that at the time I went, I got to go all in one trip. And it's an eight-hour trip. And then you're in McMurdo for a couple of days being processed and getting acclimated. And then you fly to the pole, which is another 800 miles, on a cargo plane that is equipped with skis for landing on the packed snow. And when you get off the plane, it was on average about minus 25 to minus 27 degrees Fahrenheit.
And that's in the summer.
Yes, that's the high. And we had 14 knots of wind by and large, so it was about a minus 46 chill, wind chill factor. And you're carrying all your stuff, not only your own belongings, which are very few, but all your cold weather gear. So I was carting along about another 75 pounds of stuff and stepping off an airplane at 10,000 feet in minus 25 degrees.
Good heavens.
Well, you so prepare for it.
People who go to the South Pole, scientists who decide that they want to work there and so on, they must have a certain, first of all, love of cold weather, but also real spirit of adventure and willingness and desire to take risks.
It's the research is risky from a number of point of views, in that all research is risky because you're probing something you don't know anything about. You're always pushing the envelope. But also, you have to plan every iota of your experiment, everything you need to have with you. And you have to pack it in such a way that it doesn't break. Because, you know, you've got a 3-month window and you have certain things you plan to do.
And you can't go to the store and get a new one.
You can't, no. So people are adventurous. But on the other hand, I was totally comfortable there. I was never cold. The gear they issue you is quite adequate. I loved my parka. It was the first time I had ever worn a uniform. I've never been in the American military. I've never worn a uniform, but uniforms are terrific. I had a pocket for everything I could possibly imagine. I always carried a water bottle, you know, my camera, my journal, my gloves, anything I might need, I had a pocket for it. And my parka went everywhere with me.
I bet it did. We're talking to Carolyn Eisenstein from the National Science Foundation, and the talk tonight is called High and Dry at the South Pole. You were there. You started to tell us about some of the scientific projects that are actually going on there. Have any of them returned results that have been of use and of benefit?
Well, very definitely. The results have very definitely been of benefit to science in its ongoing building of our understanding, for instance, of the ozone hole or of the origins and structure of the early universe. So the benefit from these may not be immediate in something that we think about as a conscious benefit, but it builds our science knowledge, and you never know when that science knowledge is going to have a huge impact. Like the first studies of ozone depletion. No one really understood what was happening. They saw it. It was definitely measurable. And then it's taken a while to understand the origins of it and what we do about it and so forth. And the same is with studies of dark energy in the universe. You know, we have theories that the universe is expanding. The universe starts, according to our theories, with the Big Bang. So when you think about that, it's sort of like a pebble in water and waves radiate out. And you would think that it would start expanding more slowly as it went out. That's sort of intuitively, that's what you think. But in fact, the universe is expanding more rapidly. So by studying the microwaves given off after the Big Bang in the early universe, it's called the cosmic microwave background, we can understand how matter began to clump together and then eventually form galaxies. And I don't know what practical use that's going to have, but
It's part of the big picture.
It's part of our knowledge and our appetite for knowledge is really what drives science.
Now, at the South Pole, there aren't any organisms, are there?
No. In Antarctica, in total, there are no vertebrates. Now, the sea around Antarctica is very rich in krill and other, and you know, all kinds of foodstuffs, and in seals and penguins and all of that. But if you look at what's native to Antarctica, the continent itself, there are no animal life really, except things like mites and midges and a few things, and no really plants to speak of, maybe some lichens and so forth. And that I'll have to sadly tell the students at the cafe that, alas, we aren't worried about polar bears.
Right.
And there's nothing to pet.
That's the North Pole.
That's the North Pole, yeah.
I remember going to an aquarium once and seeing, and I don't know whether this was the Arctic or the Antarctic, but an organism called ice worms.
Yes, there are some worms, yeah. They're very small, they're very inconsequential, and no one really knows actually whether some of these things, like the midges or the fleas, might have been brought in by birds. So they may not really be native to Antarctica, because it's quite cold, folks. I mean, at the South Pole, you know, the wind chill factor was minus 46.
Would you ever go back?
Oh, yes, in a heartbeat.
Really? Why?
Well, unlike the explorers in the early 1900s, Amundsen and Scott, I have polar fleece. I have wonderful food. I don't eat pemmican. I have an airplane to take me there and an entire infrastructure that is looking out for people.
And so being there,
I never felt in danger. I never felt worried about my personal safety or health.
What is the thrill for you of being there?
It's being in the coldest, highest, driest, windiest, emptiest, cleanest continent on Earth. Just being there. For instance, cleanest is an interesting idea because a lot of work is done at the South Pole to study the air there. It's the cleanest air on Earth. And the station to study it is called the Atmospheric Sciences Research Observatory. And it's upwind of the main station at the South Pole. There's a prevailing wind. So you can put a station there and measure the air. And you will know then the baseline of what represents clean air. And then you can always compare that to other air, which is dirty. And the interesting thing is whenever an airplane would land on the ice there, you would get a spike in your measurements from the exhaust of the airplane. Then it would dissipate and you could go back to studying it. But when you look at that spike, you think about all the airplanes that land at O'Hare every day.
Right.
Anyway, it's just fun to think about the Earth that is very different.
Carolyn Eisenstein is a retired member of the United States National Science Foundation. Carolyn, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a pleasure, Mary Charlotte.